From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today, we talk about statewide test results that we received recently. Are things getting better inside classrooms? We'll also get reaction to a controversial Georgia ruling that says it is legal for someone to take photos from underneath a woman's skirt.
The Georgia Court of Appeals overturned the conviction of a former Publix employee for criminal invasion of a woman's privacy because he did it in public.
That's a report from 11 Alive. We'll talk about that in the break room. But many of you have already chimed in with reactions to that ruling. Here are your first thoughts. Jim Sandifer writes on Facebook, "No, I'm not surprised at the court's decision or that there were no laws covering this new kind of peeping Tom yet, but my guess is that they are on the way." Hazel Studstill also writes, "Yes, the law is needed, obviously, and parents teach your children this is not okay." Jessica Eichard chimes in, "Legislation can't keep up with technology. That is what the court is saying. The laws are simply not in place to handle a situation like this." And we get this comment from Wendy Markham, who says, "So glad I voted Tuesday. Two Georgia Supreme Court seats up for grabs. This can't continue to be the status quo." We love to get your disagreements, your debates, and your views. You can call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message or post to Facebook like all those folks did. You can also find us on Twitter at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. The Georgia Department of Education released the Georgia Milestones test scores earlier this week. This is only the second year that the tests have been given. There were still some issues. Here to talk about them is Maureen Downey. She writes the Get Schooled blog for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Maureen, it's always a pleasure.
Good morning.
So, first of all, what are the differences that we see from this year's test results from last year?
Well, we only really saw slight increases this year. So I don't think we can necessarily draw too much from that, because there's simply the very natural occurrence that the teachers are more familiar with the test. It was a new test, second year of it, and it also had open-ended questions. So students last year in Georgia were confronting a standardized state exam they had never seen before, because we had done multiple choice. So, you know, I don't think we can draw too much from this the second year of the test. I mean, I think if there is one point of concern, and that is the lower performance of younger kids, the third and fourth graders. And that's something that I think the state has to explore, because teachers have been saying the content and the test are really over the heads of those kids. They are, the material's too sophisticated. So I think there is some concern, and there does need to be some follow-up on behalf of the state on the lower grades.
Remind us where the Georgia Milestones test comes from. In other words, this test was designed to get results from throughout the state, but it was also designed to sort of clear up problems that had been that the schools had experienced with earlier tests.
Well, the earlier tests we had were simply multiple choice tests. They weren't considered very rigorous. That was the CRCT, and that acronym has now been retired. And now we have the Georgia Milestones, which hasn't yielded itself to an acronym yet. But anyway, we wanted a tougher test. We wanted a test that, you know, went to this all important critical thinking skill issue, and so that's why they went to a test that has open-ended questions. But we were going to be part, you know, this goes back to history, we were going to be part of a consortium of states, and we were all going to pool our resources and create a set of great tests using the best expertise, the best research, and the problem is that best came at a higher price tag than Georgia was willing to pay, so we pulled out of the consortium and we created our own test. And there is a big picture question yet to be answered: are these tests any good? And do these tests actually tell parents anything? You know, we all assume that when a kid sits down for a test, the test reflects what they learned in class. But what parents have to remember is these tests are not created by the classroom teachers. They're created at the state level, and teachers do have input. But you never really know, frankly, whether or not your kid didn't learn the material, whether your kid wasn't taught the material. I mean, I think that that's a big question when you have exams created outside of the classroom setting.
Are these tests really designed to tell the parents something, or are they there to tell the state something?
Well, they are allegedly there to tell the parents something, although, frankly, you know, I don't think parents necessarily consult those tests. You know, the results come out in the summer. So they're also designed, they have a second a second purpose, and that is to tell the state how the schools are performing, and that is to feed into a very clumsy acronym, the College and Career Ready Performance Index, or CCRPI, and that is now the new way that schools in Georgia are rated. So these tests have great import to the standing of the school because it is, you know, a key factor in how Georgia rates its schools.
And what are the effects should a school fail those markings or come below where they're supposed to according to the state?
Well, there's all sorts of tiers of intervention, but of course the big thing now, the big danger or threat to the schools from their perspective would be state takeover. And that brings us to the Opportunity School District, which is Governor Deal's idea. Voters will actually have to decide whether or not he can do it, because allowing the state to come in and take control of a school, take it over, that's not allowed right now in our Constitution. So in November, Georgia voters will decide whether or not to agree with Governor Deal that the state should be able to kind of swoop in and take over, and those takeover schools, the ones on the list, are really there because of low performance on these state exams. And that includes largely schools in Atlanta, DeKalb, and a couple in Clayton. And I think that's where we're going to see the state takeover effort, if in fact voters give the state that power.
Is it only the results of the milestone tests that determine, let's say that the legislation passes, that the Opportunity School Districts are implemented, is it only the milestone test that determines whether the state will come in and take over a local school or not?
Well, the College and Career Ready Performance Index is sort of a complicated animal that many factors looks at many factors, but essentially it is academic performance and student growth, and that is being determined in the state of Georgia by test scores. So I would say the test scores are the dominant controlling factor in whether or not a school is eligible and will in fact be taken over by the state of Georgia.
So we would love to hear from those of you out there listening, whether you be a teacher, a student, or a parent. Do you think the milestone tests and tests like them are a good way to measure student performance? Did your child have any issues when they took the test? You can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation that's happening on Facebook. My guest is Maureen Downey. She writes the AJC's Get School Blogged. So Maureen, let's go back to the results of these tests. Now, granted, 2 years' worth of results is no way to figure out a trend. But the state is sort of touting these results as improvement. Is that fair?
You know, again, I think it's factual. There's been a slight improvement overall. I'm looking at the English language arts now, for example, for statewide. And, you know, you see slight improvement over last year. I mean, I think if you all, you know, the state has a very nice bar graph that will show you improvement and how many of our students are at the very top level, which is called distinguished learners. You know, when we still only have 7% of our ninth graders in literature, 11% of our kids who take American Lit, we only have, 6% of our fifth graders at distinguished, and that's a high bar. Distinguished is high. Proficiency and distinguished are the two highest. But, you know, I do think that, we still have not enough Georgia students performing at the highest levels, and that's always been the case in Georgia. We need to get the kids not just at proficiency level, but better than proficiency level. So, you know, when you look at this, you will see we have, you know, we do have more kids scoring at proficient, except again in the lower grades, where we have, I think, some concerns of what's happening there. You know, I would not, break out the champagne over these results, quite frankly.
And you mentioned that some people say that lower grades did not do well because the material may have gone over their head. How is that debate going? Could we see changes in the milestones test because the results we've seen from the younger kids?
Well, you know, I do think that Superintendent Woods, the person who leads the Department of Education now, I think he's open to teacher response. So I think they will look at this issue. I think that the idea of what kids are capable of in lower grades, you know, there's a lot of debate about that. Who think we have pushed kids too much, and there's people who think that we're not pushing them enough.
Okay, so the milestone test stays, correct? It just gets tweaked. It's not going anywhere.
No, it's not. This is our test. This is our state exam. We are, for better or worse, stuck with it.
And we have to, the voters themselves, I say we because we're all voters, will decide whether or not this test then has implications for control of local schools.
Yes, and the bigger question is whether or not we think the state can come in and do a better job than the locals, and that is particularly targeting, I would say, again, Atlanta and DeKalb schools, whether or not the state can do a better job bringing those low-performing schools. And certainly, you know, Atlanta had two schools, two elementaries with zero proficiency in English language.
Wait, what does that mean? How can you have zero proficiency?
Well, what you mean, what we mean by that is that they had no schools where their students were proficient. So there's, you know, four categories: beginning, developer, proficient, and distinguished. And proficient is sort of what we're calling passing, just to put it in the vernacular. I think it was Fain Elementary and Thomasville Heights. Neither of those schools had any kids who went beyond beginner or developing. So that is an issue in third grade English. And of course, Dr. Kristoff and the superintendent's already taken some steps. Thomasville will be taken over. That is going to be a school that she's handed over to the group that actually is behind Drew Charter to bring in new innovation to sort of remake that school. So I think she understands that. I mean, these superintendents know their troubled school. It's a question of what they're if they're doing enough. And, you know, Thomasville Heights, they're remaking that school from the ground up as a result of low performance.
So what do you, somebody who follows this news, who has followed the milestones test since its implication, during its design, what do you take away from this, and what were there any surprises for you?
I would not say there are any surprises, again, because the second year only saw incremental increase, and that simply is the natural process with new tests. You know, I do think that I do have questions about validity of this test. I would feel a lot better if the state of Georgia could come out with convincingly strong outside evaluation of this test and reassure all of us this test is a good test. This test is telling us something about what's happening in the classroom. And in fact, the word alignment, is your kid learning what's being tested? And I think that's an important question for parents to ask. Most of us who have older kids have kids come home at least once, you know, a year and say, nothing I had in class was on that AP test. I mean, that happens. And it's sometimes simply that there was a different focus or the test itself, when it's made by an outside of company and not the teacher, simply went for things that class never got to or never got to deeply. So I do think it's important that the state can tell parents this test is really an accurate reflection of what your child knows or doesn't know, and I'm not sure the state of Georgia can tell us that yet.
And we also can't answer whether or not teachers will have to teach to the test. Is that correct?
Well, teachers have to teach to the test, and that's only a problem if it's a lousy test. So, you know, I think teachers have always taught, you know, they've always taught to the test, but it was their own test. I mean, what's happened now is we've given a lot of weight to non-teacher-created tests because the argument is the teachers weren't creating strong enough tests. They were, you know, grade inflation, all that stuff. You know, which is interesting because it remains true that at least in college performance, high school grade point average is the best indicator of your child's ability to do well in college.
Yeah.
Even more so, the SAT, you know, has that first year predictability, but overall, it's grade point average. So even though we complain about grade inflation and that high school grades mean nothing, the research doesn't really bear that out.
Yeah. That's Maureen Downey. She writes the AJC's Get Schooled blog. Maureen, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, and have a good weekend, everybody.
This is On Second Thought.
A crocodile. No, you can't get friendly with a crocodile.
Let's add a couple more songs to our Georgia playlist. That's our collection of the best songs from and about Georgia. The rules are very simple. All tunes have to be written or performed by a Georgian, and musicians cannot pick one of their own songs. So today's selections come from Atlanta jazz singer Gwen Hughes. Her new album, Native Land, came out this month. Here are her two picks for the Georgia playlist.
Warmer than a summer night.
My first pick for the Georgia playlist is an older song. The music was originally written by Lionel Hampton, and the words were added to the melody later by the great Georgia lyricist Johnny Mercer. Midnight Sun. Johnny Mercer created utter poetry.
Each star its own aurora borealis. Suddenly you held me tight.
Ah, That's just, and then that's the climax, you held me tight.
I could see the midnight sun. I can't explain the silver rain that found me.
Johnny Mercer heard the melody on the radio driving home from something in California, called up the radio station to find out what the name of the song was, and was so moved by the melody that he created this set of lyrics to go with it, and they're just poetry. She does just a beautiful, very emotional, almost sensual rendition of the song, really wraps herself around the romantic, sensual imagery of two people who love each other.
Was there ever such a night? It's a thrill I still don't quite believe.
Now she's just in shock that she had all of those feelings, and she's remembering that.
But after you were gone, there was still some stardust on my sleeve.
So lyrical, so poetic, and very distinctly Southern, I think, as well.
The flame of it may dwindle to an ember.
I sing this song to my husband. I sing this song for anybody who's in love with somebody else, because it's such a deep expression of intimacy.
And we may see the meadow in December. I see white and crystal.
Johnny Mercer makes me not be afraid to create images, to create bold images, and to go for a way of saying something that hasn't been said before.
Loving you.
The second song that I chose for the Georgia playlist is Otis Redding's I've Been Loving You Too Long.
To stop now.
This song to me really encapsulates his singular place in how he produced a song. And it's something I really relate to. It's almost like jazz in that he starts out one way and then builds to something entirely different at the end, and it tells a complete story.
With you, my life.
Just the way he sings this song is an absolute study in control and dynamics in a way I've rarely heard caught. He could just do these slow tempos. Here it is.
You were
tired. And he goes, I've been tired. And he starts off really loud, but then he pulls way back because everything goes away and he's out there on his own with nothing underneath him but a little bit of the rhythm section.
Fair goes on. I've been loving you a little too long.
This song really exemplifies what music does in the human experience, which is that it expresses what cannot be spoken.
I've been loving you a little too long. I don't wanna stop now.
The Georgia sound to me is this stew of influences, which is R&B and country. sort of lumped together. The collision of black and white, the church and the farm. And it's just this stew that's funky and gritty around the edges and will always have a cool backbeat.
That was Atlanta jazz singer Gwen Hughes with her picks for our ever-growing Georgia playlist. She has a new album out called Native Land. If you have a song that you just have to add to the Georgia playlist, we want to hear about it, and we want to hear you sing, so you can leave a message for us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk. You'll find the entire Georgia playlist series, along with all the great music segments we've done, at gpbnews.org. It's been a long week. We talked about curfews, Title I school funding, and we looked back 20 years to the moment when a bomb exploded in Centennial Olympic Park. Now it's time to let all that go, sit back, relax, and celebrate Friday. Let's head into the break room.
Orange mocha frappuccino!
I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves.
Is that your VCR? Oh my God.
Boy, crikey, she's a gnarly little Sheila.
Joining us in the break room, Eric Siegel is constitutional law professor at Georgia State University. Kathy Lohr, former NPR correspondent. HB Cho is a reporter for the Korean Daily. And Kalina Bowler is co-host of the Real Snobs podcast. Welcome back, everybody. Happy Friday.
Thank
Happy
you.
Happy Friday.
Thank
Great
you.
To be here.
We were going to start with some local news. This has surprised a number of people. The Georgia Court of Appeals recently ruled that upskirting is legal. Now, upskirting is when someone puts a camera under a woman's skirt, unbeknownst to her, and either takes a picture or takes a video of her private parts. Here's what happened. The court tossed out a previous conviction against a grocery store employee who was caught in the act. Georgia law states upskirting is only a crime when it's done in, quote, any private place and out of public view, end quote. The man's attorneys argued the woman was entitled to no reasonable expectation of privacy because she was in a public space, even though what he filmed were places of her body that she had chosen to cover. The court agreed with the man and his attorneys. So, Eric, we have to start with you. You're the lawyer here.
I blame Justice Scalia for this. The truth is, first of all, obviously in Georgia, there has to be a law against going out in a public place, taking a camera and filming a woman's private parts.
Yeah.
There just has to be.
And
in fact,
there is not yet.
Well, the court said there was not. Three dissenting judges in the Court of Appeals said there was. And there was, because there's a law in Georgia that says you cannot take pictures of someone without their consent in, quote, a private place. And the court could have interpreted that to mean, as it should have, a person's private parts. Instead, the court used a very narrow conception, shorn out of context, of what this statute means, something Scalia had been pleading for years and years and years, and many of his disciples agree with. There was more than enough space here for judges of reasonable ability to say this man shouldn't be punished for what he did. And here's the main reason. He knew what he did was wrong. We're not talking about a statute here that's so vague and you're not sure if what you're doing is wrong. What made him think he could dive under a woman and take a picture of her private parts? The answer is nothing.
But the courts have said in other states as well that this is not that doesn't apply. It's a new kind of technology, and they're being very specific to the law. And I don't agree with it, obviously. But I think that the state needs to make it clear that this is illegal, and I think they need to do it immediately in the upcoming session.
I have a question. So if the same woman was actually displaying her private parts in public place, wouldn't she have been possibly charged with public indecency?
Possibly. But Kathy, to your point, the law changes, the law evolves, and I don't think you should punish people for things they don't know are wrong or illegal. But this guy dove under her skirt four times and took
pictures. It is interesting what HB Cho says, though, because if she had just not been wearing pants or underwear, she probably would have been arrested and charged. But
But it's upskirting. It's called upskirting for a reason. Like, let this happen to a man wearing a kilt just one time. You know what I mean? Like, this, then we would not be having this discussion anymore.
Well, or if it happened to a child.
Right.
Thank you.
That would be a wholly different matter. And I want to say that Massachusetts, Texas, and New Jersey have already enacted new laws that specifically prohibit the upskirting.
Well, we'll see if our legislators act respond.
When they act, yeah.
But since we're talking about recording, remember these?
What would you call a video recorder that has everything?
I'm calling smart.
It's a Zenith VHS with extraordinary VHS hi-fi stereo.
Smart.
Plus a remote that could control both the deck and the TV.
Controls both? That's smart.
The last known company that still makes VCRs, video cassette replayers, is going out of business. The company says it plans to stop production by the end of this month because of a drop in sales. And I wonder how many of you still own a videotape?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Sentimental purposes.
Do you still own a player with which to play it?
No. Not anymore.
So, look, it's time to transfer all that to digital.
It's time-consuming, though, doing all the transfers and things, you know?
Yeah, it's gone.
It's gone, I know, but you have to get the special one that has both the DVD slot and the VHS slot, and then it takes a long time.
There are companies that do that.
I know there's companies that do that, but it's, you know, it can get expensive.
Pretty soon the DVD is going to go the way.
This is basically a public service announcement. If you own videotapes, it is time to digitize them.
I feel so insecure being a millennial and having at least half of my life's, all the photographs and whatnot, being somewhere on the internet, right? So I know if I want to go back to those photos, I can somehow find my way to those 15 years. But previously, before that, whatever that's on my VHS tapes, when I was really young and whatnot, it's all gone.
Yeah, it's gone. All right. Well, there'll probably be a lot of photos taken. Well, there have been a lot of photos taken of gators in Georgia. Thousands of people. They're expecting over 10,000 people, actually, to apply for permits to hunt gators in Georgia. So which among you, first of all, would apply for one of these permits? Which one of you wants to hunt a gator?
No.
I would. I didn't, but I would.
Okay. I would. And how many of you have eaten gator?
I have.
And? Please don't say tastes
salty
like chicken.
Salty frog.
I have not had frog.
Frog legs? You haven't had frog legs?
I have not.
There's a restaurant in Athens, Georgia that serves a burger with gator patty. That's called Gator Hater.
Very appropriate.
So yeah, actually that tasted good because that was on the game day between Florida and Georgia. So that tasted pretty good.
Gator bites are pretty good.
Yeah,
that's just the meat cut up and fried. Yeah,
I hear though there's two. It depends on what part of the gator you eat. Some of it tastes more like frog legs, and some of it tastes more like chicken. I hate to say that, but there are recipes for etouffee stew. Gator bites all over the internet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I personally, this is a revelation to me because I didn't realize Georgia had enough gators to justify a hunt because they're giving out thousands of permits.
May I suggest that's because you spend most of your time in Atlanta and not in other parts of
Georgia? Yeah, I'm in Savannah all the time.
There are gators there.
Yeah, I was about to say, but I didn't realize there was enough where they would say, oh, we need a few thousand taken out of the population.
Yeah, we remember talking about a gator showing up at the beach in Savannah a couple of weeks ago when on the same show, right?
So I guess
that was taken as a surprise of some kind. And yeah, it does surprise me too.
Any of you seen a gator in Georgia?
I have not.
You have?
Southern Georgia.
Pictures where it didn't happen. Okay, yes.
Well, I was actually going on, rattlesnake hunts and things like that.
What?
So
wait.
That was first story. But there, in those same southern Georgia areas, there are gators. I mean, there was a gator in a park just, you know, that the locals were saying, don't go to that park because they'll be out there by the swing sets.
I don't hunt at all, and I don't. But can we just hunt roaches? Can we get people to kill and hunt
there we
roaches?
Go. They're called exterminators.
Yeah, they don't work. They don't work.
Okay, someone once told me about that. Make your peace with the South.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if any of you out there listening have had an encounter with a gator in Georgia, Florida doesn't count, or New Orleans, for that matter, needs to be in Georgia. We want to see the pictures and hear the story, and especially if you were on a rattlesnake hunt, you were going to eat the rattlesnakes?
No. It was just interviewing a guy that did that. Oh, for a living.
I feel like this is going to need to be an entirely different conversation. But if those of you out there have a gator story or you're planning to hunt gators in Georgia, we definitely want to hear from you and get the pictures. You can tweet us at OSD Talk. You can post on Facebook or just call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. We are hanging out in the break room right now. My guests are Eric Siegel of Georgia State, Kathy Lohr, former NPR correspondent, HB Cho of Korean Daily, and Kalina Baller of the Real Snobs podcast. And of course, a big thank you as always to Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that is fueling our break room guests this morning, at least their minds. You can find them online at savannahcoffee.com. And since we're on the subject of coffee, it turns out either fewer people are drinking Starbucks or the people who do drink it are drinking less. The company CEO thinks he knows why.
We don't want to use the current situation and the uncertainty and the pressure on the consumer as an excuse. But there's no doubt that we are navigating through a very unusual time.
That is Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz in an interview with CNBC. And by unusual time, what he meant was the election year, recent acts of terrorism, and police brutality. But we wondered, does coffee consumption, is it tied to political issues? What is driving down Starbucks numbers for real?
I don't think that any social or political turmoil is leading to their downturn.
No, you don't buy it.
Coffee sales. No. In fact, I think probably journalists drink more coffee during election year,
it's true.
If anything. But I think that it has something to do with their marketing and how they've changed. They're not the small coffee shop atmosphere that they used to be anymore.
I was in New York a few months ago. There were about six Starbucks in a 5-block radius. Literally. I'm not making that up. One block Starbucks, next block Starbucks. They're going through a cycle. It's a business cycle. It has nothing to do with the American consumer. They need something new to change who they are.
They're oversaturated, maybe.
Yeah. I am a former Starbucks barista. And interestingly enough, when I worked there over a decade ago, it did feel like the smaller coffee shop thing. You actually had to pull the espresso shots by hand. You didn't just push a button, and everything's so automated and everything's so McDonald-ized about Starbucks now. And their prices are going up, and then you're putting more and more sugar in things. Listen, sometimes you just want a normal latte. And these local companies, these local like coffee shops and things, they're really stepping up their coffee game. And these beans they're bringing in and they're roasting, they're excellent.
Howard Schultz needs to be listening to this. HB, do you drink Starbucks?
I do a lot. And I know he was talking about just overall Starbucks numbers, not just coffee with actual beans and whatnot. But they are introducing a lot of really, summer drinks that has no coffee in it. So if, in fact, people are drinking less coffee, then maybe that's part of the reason he just keeps introducing these sugary drinks that has nothing to do with coffee.
Exactly.
What do you order when you're at Starbucks?
Just tall pie place. I'm the cheap person. And sit there for 3 hours.
That would be a journalist. Does she get free Wi-Fi?
There will come a time when caffeine will once again be deemed unhealthy in a serious way. About 10 years, it'll come.
Yeah, but will we listen to it? I don't know. In any case, let's move on to a story about the news. The very news that's supposedly driving down Starbucks sales. American intelligence officers now say they have enough information to declare that Russian spies were behind the recent hack of DNC emails. And then it was WikiLeaks that published the emails on its websites. The emails show DNC officials criticizing Bernie Sanders during his primary campaign against Clinton. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, an Australian, implied during a recent interview that the hacks were intended to damage Clinton's chances of winning.
She has pushed for the prosecution of WikiLeaks, which is still in train. So we do see her as a bit of a problem for freedom of the press more generally.
So, look, this is an Australian talking about a potential president of the United States, and the hack came from Russian spies. What do we feel about this foreign intervention?
I feel like he doesn't know what he's talking about. If he's worried about freedom of the press, he is backing the wrong person.
Just comes as Trump bounced a Washington Post journalist from
from his rally.
Yeah.
Not the first time. And I mean, There is no chance that Trump is sympathetic to any constitutional right that does not amount to, you know, a buck. I mean, there just isn't. So he's backing the wrong guy.
Well, you're a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat. So
fair enough.
Kathy, what do you think?
Well, it upsets me that Trump has not just banned the Washington Post, but pretty much a dozen media.
Yeah, many.
But if this is a hack that's trying to interfere with the U.S. election, I mean, it's a terrible sign. I mean, I don't know if that's what it is. I know that there are hackers that have Russian hackers that have been accused of interfering with European elections for a long time.
Yeah,
it could. Who knows?
I think we're just dealing with a new reality that we're just going to have to face from now. Because if we assume that they did it, and if they could, why wouldn't they? Borders are coming down in many different ways, and corporations are really now much larger entities sometimes than many of the governments. Really, even political issues, I don't think there is a clear separation between, as long as there's an interest for a party and they have the means to intervene, then they will, and I think that's just the new reality.
And, you know, those interests could just be, you know, a hacker or a hacking team that does not necessarily have to be government-backed. They could just be bored and say, let's see what chaos I can bring up on this thing. You know what I mean? Well, maybe they are Russian hackers, but they may be a Russian hacking group or two people in a basement
the intelligence officials did tie them back to the Russian spy agency.
But to the extent the Russian government was trying to interfere in American elections in this kind of way, we've been doing this to other countries in various ways for 50 years.
Fair enough. All right. So this is the kind of story that maybe you don't want to hear, frankly, because there's a new study from the National Bureau of Economic Research that finds people who regularly follow the news are way more likely to be depressed about the future. For example, media coverage of negative events can make people feel anxious and to believe that trouble is right around the corner. So is this enough to make you take a break from the headlines every once? Because I know all four of you are the kind of people that follow headlines, some of us because it's our profession. But is this enough to set everything down and walk away over the weekends, for example?
Yes.
So
that's coming from a journal.
So I was at a dude ranch in southern Colorado where there was no internet access, literally, for a week. There was a tiny, tiny bit in the main lodge for 10 seconds, then it was gone. So we went to the horrible things in Dallas and all that, we didn't hear about.
Oh, my gosh.
And I do have to say, and I do rock and radio shows once a week almost, I do have to say there was something exhilarating about not knowing. I mean, there was something like...
That actually sounds fabulous.
Especially that week, which was, you know, horrible week in America. Life.
Yes.
So,
you know what's funny about that is something like that to me actually sounds horrible. Like having no internet access to me. Like that, because I'm a communicative person.
You're a millennial, though. Are you not in the millennial generation?
Yeah, I am. So that sounds like I would go through a withdrawal symptom big time. And even though...
I mean, it's probably wrong for me to assume you're addicted to social media.
But I also say, yes, these news stories are very depressing. And there are times where I'm like, oh, I just need to walk away from Facebook. And every 2 days I contemplate completely closing my Facebook account. But then something draws me back in. So maybe I am addicted. Who knows?
I have a fear of... If I was having a moment like Eric was having, I think I was gonna have a fear of when somebody brings something up, a big major news that just about everybody seems to know, then I don't know, then I think I'm gonna be because I guess probably because of my job, I'll be afraid of falling behind.
And that's fair. And I was actually in the Caribbean when a lot of things happened and mountains, Justice Scalia died. I do feel like if I'm not able to comment publicly on Twitter or Facebook or blogs that my career is in jeopardy. But having said that, in the beautiful surroundings of Colorado with rivers and lakes and horses, there was something.
Yeah, see, that sounds like a slice of heaven.
There was something liberating.
Yeah. Well, I can just say, sorry.
I was recently at a lake in Missouri, beautiful, and there was very little internet access, and we were way off the road, and it was a long way to get to anywhere, and it was actually really quite nice.
I actually turn my phone off regularly over the weekend. But we want to hear from the listeners out there. Do you ever give yourself a break from headlines? Do you walk away from the internet? You can tweet us.
I just haven't tried being completely
You can
off.
Catch up.
Yeah.
It's Friday. We are hanging out in the break room. My guests are HB Cho of The Korean Daily, former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr, Kalina Baller of The Real Snobs podcast, and Eric Siegel of Georgia State University. Speaking of Colorado, let's talk about pot. The agriculture industry is a huge part of Georgia's economy, obviously hugely important here. That's because we've got a great climate, lots of sunlight, good soil. Crops like blueberries do very well here. We're the number one blueberry state. Peaches, pecans, obviously. But it could be that Georgia is missing out on another cash crop.
Say, man, you got a joint?
No, none on me, man.
It'd be a lot cooler if you did.
So it turns out Atlanta is the 10th best city for growing marijuana in the nation. It is still illegal here, though, to grow marijuana. Let me repeat that for everyone listening. It is illegal to grow marijuana.
But not to take pictures of women's skirts.
In Georgia. Fair enough.
So backwards. So.
But
backwards.
I wonder, look, let's leave all the morality out of it. Are we missing out on a valuable crop?
Yes. Yes, we are.
Okay.
I've actually mentioned this on this show several months ago. We brought up a topic similar to this, whether or not farmers who need extra income or something like that, whether they should consider pushing for legislation that would allow them to grow marijuana crops for medical purposes or something like that. And I said, absolutely. I mean, it's a no-brainer to me. Like you said, we have the perfect climate. There's obviously a growing marketplace out there, not just recreationally, but medically. And, you know, the strains that are, you know, needed and that are sought after can easily grow here.
I think there is so much data. This is a pet peeve of Pete Dominic, our friend. Drug companies that make painkillers are the ones who are fighting against making marijuana legal in places, because they know that if you're sick and you know, that pot is way more effective in every way, less addictive, and not a single human being in the history of the planet has died from a pot overdose.
Come on and preach it.
And opiate deaths are rising. Why? It's inevitable. It's going to happen. Can Georgia get out a little bit in front, or not in front, or, you know, just a little bit in front, and do the right thing? Just one time?
Pete Dominic is a radio host on Sirius. Go ahead.
I don't think so. Here's the state fact sheet. It says federal law makes it illegal to grow marijuana, and there's a whole the state.
This
puts
is
these
printed
out
from the state website.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the penalties.
We're radio. They can't see you holding up those documents.
So sorry. But, you know, so I don't know how soon the state's going to be willing to.
Why can't we do it once? Why can't we be out in front once? Just one time. On one issue. Somewhere, someday.
We can. Come on.
We can.
Been in front on other
Name
stuff.
One.
I can't. I'm not thinking of it now, but I'm sure. Wait, hey. Electric cars.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Thank you.
Because I couldn't think of one either.
I will say this. From my limited experience in Colorado, 1 week, there were as many ways to use this product that didn't involve smoking as there was to involve smoking. It does make me think that not just crops are – well, this is serious, though. I mean, it may be that non-crop use of this product will exceed crop use eventually. But the point is, it's really for people in pain. I mean, that's what we. I mean, that's that. People in pain should be able to get this drug.
Absolutely, I agree with you. And because we have the climate, we can grow it here, and we can grow some excellent strains here.
How do you know?
I just know.
Okay, we're going to move on to a very controversial subject this week. First Lady Michelle Obama spoke on the first night of the Democratic National Convention. There was one or two sentences in that speech that have since made headlines.
I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves. And I watch my daughters, two beautiful, intelligent black young women, playing with their dogs on the White House lawn.
Now, historical documents support her statement. It is true that slaves, in large part, built the White House. But Fox host Bill O'Reilly, along with many others, took offense.
Slaves that worked there were well fed and had decent lodgings provided by the government.
Okay, so here's my question. Let's get away from what we think necessarily of Bill O'Reilly. But I got a whole bunch of tweets from people who are very angry about that statement. They said it wasn't just slaves. There were other people involved, which is true. That's fair enough. But my question is, why does this upset people so much? Why can't you just say categorically, because it's factual, the White House was built in large part by slaves, and not have people get upset? Why?
I've studied and written about race in America from the beginning. And because for some reason, even in 2016, people want to deny that the number one public policy issue in 1787, 1865, 1925, and 2016 in this country is race. So anything that triggers that idea that we're still fighting about race gets people really upset. And it's, I'm being dead serious now. It has always been the number one public policy issue in America and continues to be, and that upsets people.
I have to say this is one of the most outrageous statements. I know you said, you know, from
you mean Bill O'Reilly saying they were well fed. Yeah.
But I think now you're going to think this is really crazy. I think it's like the people that say Sandy Hook never happened. And it is that people want to disassociate themselves from these events.
Just denial.
Slavery.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Straight up.
And the truth is that slavery was responsible for much of the economic prosperity for white landowners in the South and other places in the
everywhere.
Country.
We actually don't have any historical evidence that to know whether they were well-fed and whether their lodgings were decent. There's no proof of that.
I actually saw some writings, and I can't remember who was quoting it, but it was maybe the First Lady at the time, saying these slaves don't look like they're very well fed, so it's really interesting.
What difference does it make anyway?
And yes, and as a matter of fact,
even if they were well fed and given housing, they weren't slaves. They were slaves. They had no, you know, free will of their own. They couldn't go to and fro without papers. You know what I mean? And this is okay. Clean it. Calm down.
You know, my high school history teacher had. When we were going through, when we're talking about this period of the history, he insists upon telling us how there were the conditions were a lot nicer than is depicted.
Yeah, that's what I don't get.
Yes, yes.
Really? And I think I remember being confused why that he was so insistent on that.
It is a question. I mean, we're out of time, but it is a question. And definitely, if you have thoughts out there while you're listening, you need to get them to us. We are. This is The Break Room. We're out of time. I want to say thanks to our guests. You just heard H.B. Cho of The Korean Daily, former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr. Eric Siegel is a constitutional law professor at Georgia State University, and Kalina Baller, co-host of The Real Snobs podcast. But again, get us your thoughts about this. I would love to hear them on whatever side you come from. Call us at 404-500-9457. Tweet us at OST Talk. You can tweet straight to me. It's at Celeste Headley. For today and the week, it's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great weekend.